Weekly. Your all-access pass to everything White Sox.
Swing and drive! Deep to left! Gone!
That was as hard as a baseball can be hit by anybody.
White Sox Weekly on the home of the White Sox, ESPN Chicago.
Now, here's your host, Jeff Mellor.
Happy Saturday. I hope you're having a fantastic holiday weekend here ahead of Labor Day. I'm Jeff Mellor. Welcome on into White Sox Weekly, as we do each and every Saturday, 2 hours prior to our pregame coverage starting. As I like to say, this is just extended White Sox pregame coverage. We're talking White Sox baseball with you for the next couple hours. If you want to jump aboard, 312-332-3776. That's the number if you want to talk some Sox with me leading up to our pregame show, which will officially begin at 5:30 because we have a 6:10 first pitch tonight here at Wright Field as the White Sox will take on the Twins in the second of three games in this series before, oddly, the White Sox actually have Labor Day off. Usually, across baseball, most teams will play oftentimes on Labor Day, but just happened that this season, a Monday off day for the White Sox falls on Labor Day, so they will be playing tonight, and also tomorrow night, I should mention, as we have a Sunday night game here at Wright Field. Been a minute since the White Sox have been on Sunday night baseball. They have not been on the new Peacock, or should I say NBC version. It will be Peacock tomorrow with NBC carrying the Notre Dame football game. So Peacock exclusive, White Sox and Twins tomorrow night at Wright Field. Again, some Sunday night baseball for you. But that is tomorrow. Let's get to today, this past week, what's going on with the White Sox. We have some artist renderings dropping for a new stadium earlier this morning, which is interesting to say the least, as minority owner Justin Ishbia, along with Canal Edge, a developer, announced plans for a new development near the 78, and they're deeming it the Rail Yard. So we'll talk about that, actually. John Greenberg of The Athletic, who had a write-up on it, is going to join me at 4 o'clock today, and I'll ask John about his thoughts on these renderings, and we'll get into that a little bit more detail. But first things first, let's recap what happened last night here on Friday night. White Sox, a nice bounce-back victory after dropping 3 of 4 in Houston. They also finished their road trip 3 and 4 after taking 2 of 3 from these very Twins that they're playing here at Wright Field this weekend. But yeah, after dropping 2 in a row, in Houston, it was a nice effort last night by the White Sox, as I'm going to have to go ahead and say this again, but team MVP, at least in my opinion, he has been not just the most valuable player, but the heartbeat of the team. Miguel Vargas got things started early, giving Eric Fetty an early lead.
Vargas drives one in the air the other way. It's deep, right center field. It is gone. Number 30. 1-0 in the first.
Woke him up.
Love to see that from Miggy. He had been stuck on 29 for a bit, so he enters the 30 home run club, which we were just waiting for. You knew it was going to happen eventually because of the season that he's had. Like I said, he had been stuck on 29 for a little bit, but was lovely to see him jump out early on Zebby Matthews, who I should note, Zebby Matthews making his second consecutive start against the White Sox. His previous outing last Sunday, he carried a perfect game into the sixth against the White Sox. They struggled against Zebby Matthews all day last week, and it was nice to see the White Sox jump on him early. Didn't take long for Braden Montgomery to follow up Miguel Vargas' home run. Braden Montgomery in the bottom of the second.
1-1 is hammered in the air, right center, and gone! Braden Montgomery makes it 2-0.
Looked like he was sitting on that cutter.
Sixth homer of the year for Braden Montgomery. And I will say this, you know, Braden Montgomery is somebody who I don't know what he's going to end up being able to tap into this season because it is his rookie year. And obviously he arrived in June, so he didn't even have the early part of the season to get acclimated to the big league. So it is absolutely a learn as you go situation for Braden Montgomery playing in big games here down the stretch. And, you know, you see it not just, I should note, The homer was really nice, of course, but the defense that he played last night, making quite a few good reads and some nice difficult catches also, doesn't necessarily get enough love, but he has been a rock in right field. He's got a great arm. Now, hasn't necessarily had as many putouts with when it comes to assists from the outfield, but his arm, I think, has on numerous occasions kept the opposition from taking extra bases. So Brad Montgomery continues to show defensively he's going to be a good one in right field. And I continue to believe that he's going to be a very good player, if not a perennial all-star player, as he gets a little bit older and a little bit more seasoning. And he just has this maturity about him. And last night it was nice to see him hit a home run. And we moved to the bottom of the fourth. It wasn't just the one Montgomery home run. Of course, you know, the White Sox have a couple of Montgomerys on the roster.
The 0-1. Hit in the air deep to right. Another Montgomery's gone deep. Two-run homer for Colson. It's 4-0.
You called it. You said that the big boys like to share the moment.
Yeah, DJ was referencing how Len Casper, shortly after Miguel Vargas had homered yesterday, mentioned he wouldn't be surprised if Colson Montgomery and or Munetaka Murakami homered last night, because having seen Miguel Vargas go yard, it's just something that has happened quite frequently this year, that when one of the power hitters hits a homer in a game, quite often one of the other big boppers comes through, and that, of course, was the case last night, as Colson Montgomery also entered the 30 home run club with his home run last night. So the White Sox now have a pair of players with 30, and Munetaka Murakami sitting on 29 right now as we speak. So it would be pretty cool if Mune could join the 30 home run club here fairly shortly and give the White Sox a trio of hitters to hit 30 home runs. That is something that does not happen as often as maybe you would think. So it would be pretty cool if Mune could maybe become a member of that club tonight or tomorrow night and join his fellow compadres, Colson Montgomery and Miguel Vargas, with 30 homers on the season. And Eric Fetty, I should note, he gave the White Sox 5 really solid innings yesterday. Went 4, and it looked like Will Venable might have been strongly considering going to Hagen Smith, but because the White Sox ended up adding on that 2-run shot by Colson Montgomery in the bottom of the 4th, Will decided to give Eric Fetty the opportunity to go out in the 5th, and great work by Fetty. A little bit of loud contact in the 5th, but he went 1-2-3 and was able to get through 5, which is quite honestly something that the White Sox have not been getting enough of from their starting pitching. So it was a breath of fresh air to have Fetty do what he did last night, go 5 shutout innings and pick up the win. He was able to pick up the win because the bullpen also was excellent. Hagen Smith did come on after Fetty was done in the 5th, had 2 shutout innings, struck out 3. And what was encouraging about that is that this was the first time that Hagen Smith was going up against an opponent who had seen him previously. First time the Twins got a look at Hagen Smith last weekend, so this was a chance for them to see him a second time within about a week. And that is always a litmus test in baseball when a reliever has to face an opponent, the same opponent, in a short period of time, because they've got the opportunity now to see his delivery, especially someone like Hagen Smith, who has a funky delivery that works in his favor. So for him to go out last night and give the White Sox 2 shutout innings, 3 strikeouts, was a really nice sign of what hopefully will be more good things to come. Hagen Smith, with those 2 shutout innings, lowered his ERA on the season to a very nice 0.69. You love to see that. And Brian Hudson, as you would expect, he went an inning scoreless. And then what was a little bit surprising, Grant Taylor came on in the 9th with a 4-run lead, so a non-save situation. And Grant Taylor found himself in a little bit of trouble. Josh Bell, actually the leadoff hitter in the 9th, hit a home run to get the Twins on the board. And then after a couple of groundouts, Grant Taylor found himself in a little bit of trouble after a single and a walk. So a couple runners aboard meant that the tying run came to the plate. At least, though, Grant Taylor was able to bear down when it mattered most.
The 2-1. Keyshaw, it's a fly ball out into right. Braden is there. He's got it. And the White Sox win. 4-1, the final. Got a little hairy, but Grant Taylor gets out of it.
So Taylor finishes the game off, and the White Sox beat the Twins last night 4-1. White Sox now 74-67 on the season. They drop the Twins to the old mirror image record of 67-74. Minnesota now 7 back. They're in third place. Of course, attention is firmly planted on the Cleveland Guardians, who actually swept a doubleheader last night against the Tigers. Guardians now 72-70, 2.5 back, and unfortunately, it was somewhat disappointing. It was good to see the White Sox win, obviously, and reduce the magic number to 19, but a little bit disappointing because the Guardians were trailing the Tigers in both games, and in both games, it was a decent lead, and then and also fairly late, the Tigers were up on the Twins 6-1 in the first game before the Twins came back and eventually walked off the Tigers in game one yesterday. So they won in the ninth inning 7-6. And then with a 3-1 lead in the eighth, the Guardians came back again and forced extra innings and eventually ended up beating the Tigers in both games. So it could have been a fantastic day for the White Sox. Unfortunately, though, the Guardians are not going to make it easy, but you wouldn't expect anything less. White Sox going to have to continue to take care of business if they want to go ahead and win this division, which they've proven at each and every turn this season. It is something they are capable of doing. 312-332-3776. Again, that's the number if you want to jump aboard and talk some White Sox with me. I believe we have Mike in Orland Park who wants to talk about the Sox. What's going on, Mike? You're on White Sox Weekly with Jeff Meller. What's going on, bud?
Hey, Jeff. Great that you're on. I have an opinion, and I have a question for you, too. Mm-hmm. And it goes back to the draft for White Sox. The question is that, like, I like Van Lackey because, like, you know, I think the White Sox for need as well, I think a catcher is more what they need because I'm okay with Colson Montgomery at short. You know what I mean? And that's what I was thinking. You know, that's my question for that. But my opinion is I think if they keep the White Sox together, the same team, because they are all rookies pretty much, and, you know, sprinkled in with a couple guys. But, I mean, like, if they keep this team together for the next 3 years and add some pitching, they will be, like, a World Series contender for sure.
Listen, Mike, I hope speak it into existence. Yeah, it's part of the reason why it's been such a fun team so far this year is because they are young and they're proving that they belong at the major league level. And the one thing I'm with you. Chris Getz and everybody inside the White Sox front office has done a really nice job of building this team out and turning them around as quickly as they have, right? Now, that is why I would say I'm encouraged. And I liked Von Lackey, don't get me wrong. He's the catcher you're referencing who the Minnesota Twins actually ended up drafting third overall. It really came down to Rock Chulowski, Grady Emerson and Von Lackey, and those were pretty much the consensus top three picks. You know, the only thing I'll say about Lackey is that, you know, he only really had like one outstanding season in college ball. Rock Chulowski, you know, for the last couple years has truly been the consensus number one pick. And, you know, I hear you about Colson. You know, I was actually talking with DJ. I think it was during the game, before the game actually wrapped up. But how smooth Colson Montgomery is at shortstop. He had a week and a half this year where he was making some uncharacteristic errors and some misplays, And I can't tell you this for sure. Maybe if I can, you know, chat with him in the clubhouse, I'll have an opportunity to do so and just ask him. You know, he was dealing with a back issue. He was also dealing with a leg issue after fouling a couple of balls off his leg, you know, at multiple times this season. So I think, you know, there might have been a little stretch there where he was kind of playing but dealing with some stuff that might have prevented him from playing his best defensive shortstop. But what I will say is, as good as he is at shortstop, you know, Rock Chalowski, you know, looks like somebody who a lot of people believe is going to be a Gold Glove caliber shortstop. And in the long run, I don't think that's going to be bad for this organization. If you have a Gold Glove caliber shortstop, that is great. Colson Montgomery has showed that he can handle third base and be a plus defender there. And, you know, at this point, I feel like I'm a little bit of a broken record talking about just how good it is to have just a variety of shortstops up and down your organization. Something we talked about last week, Caleb Bonimer shifting from, or maybe not shifting, but getting some starts in center field down at Double A the past week or so as the White Sox look to find ways to get him into their lineup potentially in the future here. It's not bad to have shortstops all over your organization because you know what? If they're good defensively at shortstop, if they can handle it, they can move off of that position and usually be a plus defender almost anywhere else on the diamond. You know, we're obviously not catcher. You're not going to, most people are not going to move from shortstop to catcher. But aside from that, anywhere else defensively on the diamond, usually you can figure out a way, especially if you give an elite defender at shortstop the opportunity to learn the position over a year or so in the minor leagues. Oftentimes you can see they can more than handle it. We're seeing it with Sam Antonacci in left field this season. We see it Chase Mydroth at second base. Chase came up as a shortstop. So, you know, it's an organizational philosophy that I think if you're looking at part of the reason why the White Sox have made these vast improvements and maybe why projection systems missed a little bit on them is because projection systems didn't necessarily understand how good the White Sox could be defensively and how that could go with the power that they brought to the lineup this season. So just something to think about. Yeah, I get it. Von Lackey might end up being a really good player. I don't think the White Sox are going to regret, though, having taken Rock Chalowski. Thanks for the call, Mike. Appreciate it. Hey, Sox fans, join us at the ballpark for Childhood Cancer Awareness Day tomorrow, September 6th, as the White Sox take on these very twins. 5:20 is the first pitch. 10,000 fans in attendance will receive a kid-designed hat presented by CIBC. To purchase tickets and prepaid parking, visit whitesox.com/promos. And part of the reason why I don't think the White Sox need Von Lackey is because they do have Kyle Teal on the roster. He returned to the lineup yesterday. We'll let you hear from Kyle and Will Venable on Kyle's return when we come back. This is the ESPN Chicago Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
The Rich Eisen Show, weekdays, noon to 2, ESPN Chicago.
Welcome back to White Sox Weekly. I'm Jeff Meller. Hey, White Sox fans, get access to the best seats at the best value and lock in a 2027 ticket plan today. Be here for the biggest matchups, opening day on April 1st, and exciting new promotions. Plus, enjoy flexible payment plans, savings on single games, and more. To secure your ticket plan, visit whitesox.com/2027. Part of the reason why I don't think the White Sox necessarily need Von Lackey in their system and why they were happy to take Rock Chalowski is because Kyle Teal is somebody who they envision as their long-term catcher. He returned to the lineup after making his way back from a rehab assignment in AAA Charlotte. Kyle Teal talked to the assembled media, of which I was a part, prior to yesterday's game.
I'm very excited. Going into this interview, I was like, it's going to be a lot of the same questions. I'm just ready to get going. So.
You were down there for a little bit. When did you start feeling, or when you were already going down to Charlotte, did you already feel like you were pretty close to being ready?
Yeah, I mean, when I went down, I felt really close. As the week went on there, it felt better and better. And, you know, I'm able to go catch 100% now, and I feel ready to go every day.
What does it mean when you look at the standings? We're in early September, and you guys are first place still. And all these games matter at this point.
100%. This is the best time of year to play. This in the playoffs, right? So it's just taking it one day at a time, one game at a time. The only game that matters is the game today. So,
are you honored to be catching on the Mike Basil wand giveaway night?
This is awesome. Those wands are like weapons. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, there are conflicting reports about if they actually magic wands or not magic wands. Do you want to weigh in?
The ones that they're giving out. So I would say there's Mike Vassell's got the magic. I know our fans got some magic too. So I'm excited to see him waving their wands tonight, and it's going to be a special night.
Of course, that was yesterday prior to the game, and it was a pretty fun night here at the ballpark. Lots of wands trying to cast spells to launch White Sox balls out of the park, and it worked three times. Will Venable is a big fan of Kyle Teal, and he talked about what it means to have what Kyle Teal back inside this White Sox lineup.
Very excited about Kyle joining us. Obviously, he's a guy back there that planned on being in there as our starting catcher. And obviously, his story this year of the injuries and some of the setbacks has been a tough one. But really excited to have him back in the lineup, back behind the plate, to get his energy back in the clubhouse, back on the field. Really means a lot.
How much consideration, if any, was given to three catchers heading into the Kyle Teal activation?
Yeah, I think we talked a lot about it. We talked about our needs. We talked about what it looks like for us. I think the right-handed hitting option. As you evaluate internal options, external options, and you think about what we need. A right-handed hitter that can really hit lefties was the priority over the third catcher, and that's why ultimately Tommy Pham ends up being that guy.
How much playing time is Teal going to get down the stretch?
Every time that we answer the questions about catching, want to say, hey, we want to ease him in, and at the same time, the catching position, you're not playing every single day anyway, so there's kind of built-in rest days that you have to be mindful of. I think on top of that, yes, Kyle Teal and his quick rehab stints and kind of ramp-ups, we have to be mindful, but I think it probably ends up being where, if you have three righties that series, that Teal's probably still playing two out of those three balls.
Do you think you'd work him in at the DH at all, or are you pretty happy with Benintendi creating platoon?
Yeah, I think that's a possibility, as we go here. I think, though, definitely prioritizing Benny in the lineup and in that DH position as opposed to being out in the outfield, it's just kind of how we've done that. Obviously, we spend most of this year without Teal in the lineup, so there's potential adjustments, but I think for now, you see Benny in the DH spot against right-hand pitching.
No, offensive matchups don't necessarily dictate who you're using as catcher, but is there kind of a natural platoon with the way Rodgers and Teal's productivity have been historically in their careers?
Yeah, I think that going into a series, if there's one lefty, we're probably going to line up Jake for that start and then have Kyle face the righties. I don't think we're getting a bunch of lefties here coming up. It's going to be mostly righties, so we will be mindful, as we do every day, just thinking about what it means for each of those guys and their matchups. But yeah, that could drive how you view a series for sure.
So there you go, White Sox skipper Will Venable on Kyle Teal's return to the team. He, of course, made the start last night and was the ninth hitter, as he did catch for Mike Vassell one night. Before we take a quick time out and bring in John Greenberg of The Athletic to discuss the new renderings that Justin Ishbia, minority White Sox owner, revealed earlier today, let's pause 10 seconds for stations to identify themselves.
This is ESPN Chicago, home of the White Sox. WMVP WTBC HD2 Chicago, a Good Karma Sports radio station.
When we come back, John Greenberg of The Athletic joins me here on the ESPN Chicago Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Captain Jay Hood, weekday morning, 6 to 9, ESPN Chicago.
White Sox Weekly, Jeff Meller live at Rate Field, getting set for game 2 of 3 between the White Sox and Twins. A little Sunday Night Baseball coming your way tomorrow. It's been a while since the White Sox have had a game on Sunday Night Baseball. But before we get there, let's talk a little bit about an interesting reveal that came down. I was amused when John Greenberg put it out there, and he called it a big Saturday morning news dump as Justin Ishbia and his development team that he's working with, Canal Edge, released renderings of what they're calling the Rail Yards, a future stadium near the 78, right where the Chicago Fire are building their new stadium. And As I bring in John Greenberg of The Athletic, he had a good write-up on it for The Athletic this morning. And John, thanks for hopping on White Sox Weekly with me. I'm curious because, you know, I'm wrapping my head around it. I don't even know what to call, you know, a Friday news dump, a Saturday news dump in the less than 24-hour news cycles that we're living in. So it just got me wondering, what do you think was the impetus for why you would release Saturday morning renderings of a new stadium when I would think that's something that you would want to put out on a Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday to get it in the bloodstream of your public? What were your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's kind of, it's kind of weird, right? Maybe someone was breaking it. I don't know. Like, they were trying to get ahead of something.
Yeah.
The interesting thing, too, is that, you know, his I guess he did an exclusive interview. I don't have a subscription to Cranes, like most people don't, that aren't in the business world. So I think he might have given an exclusive actual interview to Cranes.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea. Sometimes Saturdays work because nothing else is going on.
Yeah.
I know when I actually broke the news of Ishbia, when I broke it last year, the news of Ishbia, you know, buying more minority shares, the idea of being the majority shareholder of the White Sox, that actually we released on a Friday night just because we were ready to go.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's just that could be the push. But yeah, I was like, Saturday morning, I was like, what the heck?
Especially,
I had stuff to do.
Especially when we throw in the context too, John Greenberg joining me here on White Sox Weekly, of the fact that, hey, it's a Saturday before Labor Day, a holiday weekend, and we know that the NFL gets underway next week. So it was just an interesting thing because it is one of those things where, you know, I've got a lot of White Sox fans in my life who were immediately sending me, you know, the news first and foremost, and then, you know, wanting my thoughts and reaction to it. And it's one of those things where my first initial thought is, okay, these look pretty sweet, I'm not going to lie, but I'll also admit that, hey, I feel like the lowest bar, if you're going to release renderings of a new stadium, is for it to look cool.
Yeah. If it looks bad, that's a big problem.
Yes.
If you have bad renderings, like if you that might show that things aren't going to work out. Hey, remember the Bears' new lakefront stadium? That looked cool.
Of course, yeah. No, that's how I said. It's like the lowest bar that a team has to clear if they're thinking about this. So what's interesting, and I know you mentioned it breaking the story back when you did. You had the quotes from Justin Ishbia back in November about the idea of, hey, I don't know when it's going to open, whether it's in 4 years or 34 years. And, you know, obviously the first thing is, okay, you're not releasing renderings if you're planning for this to be opening in 34 years. There's obviously a much stronger push for it to happen sooner. What do you know about what the plans are surrounding the area? Because the one thing that I will say when you look at the renderings, which, again, if you haven't checked them out, if you're a Sox fan, they're definitely worth checking out. But what is noticeably absent is where people might park in these renderings.
Well, yeah.
So, you know, what stands out to you and what were your thoughts?
Well, I think it's, you know, probably going to be pretty comparable to the Cubs, right? They don't have parking lots. They have one. And it took forever to get that parking lot. They didn't even, I used to have purple lot tickets for media where you're parking right where that park is outside. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it was like, you're parking like right by the entrance. It was kind of crazy if you think about it. And that wasn't that long ago. So, yeah, I think the idea of tailgating for Sox games if they build this new park isn't going to be the same. I think there'd probably be more of like an open air kind of park where people could congregate before games, you know, like where a bar is and things like that. I do think like it's kind of, you know, improbable that you would build a new stadium closer in the city and have a lot of parking there. There's just not that much space. So, that's one thing. I do think obviously putting it up against the Chicago River with a view that would face the Chicago skyline, I think those are very enticing, you know, designs. I like the idea of a stadium kind of district, you know, with the fire across the river. You know, a lot of cities have that, and Chicago doesn't. I always found that interesting that, you know, I know there was talk back way, way back in the day of when they built the new Sox Park, that they were going to put it in the west side, you know, next to where the Bulls played, which was still Chicago Stadium, and then became the United Center, and but that didn't go through. That was even before that happened. That was shot down as a political. You know, the interesting part is the political center of the city is so much different now because listen, this wouldn't be happening if a Daley was mayor. They wouldn't be leaving Bridgeport. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So I think the fact that the politics have shifted a little bit and who's in charge and where the Chicago power is in politics would have a lot to do with it. But I mean, I feel two kinds of ways about it. One, I would feel bad for the people of Bridgeport.
Yeah.
Especially since they're going to put like a new, you know, they're trading with Amtrak, and Amtrak's going to put like a maintenance facility. You're telling me these people are losing the baseball stadium and gaining a, you know, a railway maintenance facility. That's not exactly a fair trade. That's like, you know, that's like trading Fernando Tatis Jr. and getting James Shields.
Yeah,
you know, it's just not. It's not great. It's not a great trade.
It's not
but
when
I
you
feel bad for them.
Yeah, no, and I think it's a fair thing to point out. John Greenberg of The Athletic joining me. He had the write up this morning as the renderings by Justin Ishbia and Canal Edge were released for what they would hope to put together as a future project for a new White Sox stadium that they're calling the Rail Yards. In the 78, right across, as John mentioned, from the new Chicago Fire Stadium that is planned to be opening here. So, you're right, that's the other aspect of this that obviously a lot of White Sox fans are initially resistant to is the idea of leaving Bridgeport. And I saw already that the 11th Ward has already responded with a statement. And it's certainly, I believe they referenced a betrayal. And it's obviously going to put this into an interesting situation. What do you think, John, about the fact that Justin Ishbia, who I know you mentioned in your piece, you know, will have the option to become majority owner at the earliest in 2029, but by 2034 at the latest. What do you think about how he's navigating his current situation as the minority owner, but also with the idea that, hey, eventually I will be hopefully purchasing this team, becoming the majority owner, and then I want to look forward. So how does he navigate, you know, these next few years with Jerry Reinsdorf still the chairman?
Well, yeah, and like he said, and, you know, I quoted my story, everything, stadium stuff's all Jerry. That's what he would say. And then I had a quote in the original story I did back in November where he said, you know, the White Sox said, we're focused on the 78. So that's kind of interesting, too, is that they're I guess, working in kind of tandem here. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, Jerry's in charge of everything. You know, I asked, Ishbia told me he doesn't know anything about anything, you know, with any White Sox moves. He doesn't get any heads up, which I'm not sure I totally believe. But I do know that, you know, Jerry's not exactly a power-sharing kind of owner. Kind of, he does, like, you look at the board that's listed in the media guide, those guys' average age is, like, 95. So I don't think he's running a lot of things by them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think Jerry does make those decisions, but I think in this case they'd be working in unison because it's his separate business that's buying this land. It's not the team.
Mm-hmm.
Like, whereas, you know, the Bears, you know, the McCaskey family bought the land in Arlington Heights. It's not the same. His separate business entity bought the land.
Yes.
Is finishing up buying the land from Amtrak. So it would be kind of like a perfect, you know, perfect thing here. And I think that's kind of when, listen, the original thing with this is he was trying to buy the Twins, and then
yep.
the Reinsdorf came to him, you know, and I reported this back when I first reported the story, they came to him, said, well, if you're going to buy into the Twins, he had a, you know, kind of a very not, well, it wasn't, not a lot of people knew about it, but he had a small piece as a minority partner of the White Sox. And they said, well, why don't you just like work to increase this? And, you know, Jerry, you know, we'll talk about you taking over one day. And I think that had to be in mind. Remember, Jerry had been talking about moving to the 78 before the fire did.
Yep.
So you have to wonder, Jerry has a legacy here, and he wanted to get a new park before he's gone. And that's what he said. He wants to get that settled. So by aligning himself with someone who has a lot of money and can pull off this development where Jerry would not be able, where Jerry wasn't able to get public money,
mm-hmm.
this would make a lot of sense for him.
Well, and I think
he wants to get that done.
And I think, and John Greenberg of The Athletic joining me here on White Sox Weekly, I think that's, you know, a key point too, is that it looks like obviously a large majority, if not almost all of it, would be privately financed. And that is the stark difference between obviously what's trying to be accomplished by the Bears, who there's obviously a ton of overlap. Sox fans, a lot of them are huge Bears fans. And so, you know, it's something that is in constant discussion here about what the Bears are trying to do, and it seems like they're wandering around aimlessly. And just in comparison, like how different things can be when you're not reliant on public financing.
100%. And I mean, listen, the big story about the fire was that it was all gonna be public finance, and then it comes out that they're going to get about, you know, $400 million in TIF dollars for the mm-hmm. infrastructure, and that's kind of what the Bears are asking for too. The key difference to me really is that they're more organized. You know, that Ishbia is, you know, is one, is a real billionaire.
Mm-hmm.
He's got development experience. It just, it seems a lot more organized than what the Bears did, where they bought the land and still haven't built anything on it. I honestly think you have to think that Ishby is doing this with the idea of building, having something built by 2030, right, when their lease is up, or pretty close, because the lease is up after the 2029 season.
Correct.
That's around the time he could possibly take over. You have to think that 2030 or 2031 would be a target date for a new South Loop ballpark to open, which means, you know, they got to get stuff approved and going pretty quickly. And it seems like their ducks are in a row.
Yeah, no, and that's kind of, you know, maybe you just put it a little bit more succinctly. But yeah, that was the whole idea of, look, you know, when he says 34 years, never, you don't release renderings with the idea that, hey, maybe in 30 years from now we'll get this thing built together. Because obviously who knows what kind of world we're going to be living in and what the surrounding neighborhood might look like at that point. You want to put this stuff into action. I think that's the key point. One final thing, John, and obviously if there's anything you want to add, feel free. The one thing I noted, and, you know, this is something completely simple that could be immediately switched if it was deemed something that they wanted to keep. I found it interesting that the pinwheels were not put, the scoreboard pinwheels were not placed on the rail yards renderings, which I just found interesting because I think that is the one unique feature here at Raitt Field that really does make Sox Park stand out as its own, right? And so I thought that would be something that you could
put that up there.
What's up?
I was just going to say, I think that was probably just like
a slight omission.
A lack of maybe having someone on the renderings team that would say that. Yeah, I don't think the pinwheels thing is like a deal breaker. I can't imagine they wouldn't want to put that in there.
Yeah, not that it should be. It's just one of those things where it's like, hey, was this done deliberately? And it's certainly possible that they're like, hey, you know what? Give us the best possible renderings you can. And it's somebody who is not a Sox fan who wouldn't be like, hey, one last thing, throw up the pinwheels on the scoreboard and you'll have everybody eating out of your hands. So.
Right. I don't know if I see the retired numbers in it either.
I don't see a number 13 for Ozzy out there, so we'll have to get to work on it. John, appreciate your time. Thanks for hopping on, especially on short notice and on your holiday weekend here. So we'll be reading in The Athletic. Obviously, it was a good piece, and keep on keeping on. We appreciate the work you're doing, man.
All right. Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
John Greenberg, again, of The Athletic. He had the write-up this morning on the renderings that Justin Ishbia and his team, his developmental team that he's working with, released in regards to a new Sox stadium that they would hope to put. They're calling it the Rail Yards. It is right across from the 78 where the Chicago Fire intend to build their new stadium. So very interesting times here that we are discussing. But, of course, they're interesting because the White Sox are interesting. The team obviously has a foothold right now on first place in the American League Central. They're 2.5 up on the Guardians, and they have a big series with the Guardians in Cleveland as well that I want to dive into a little bit here. So plenty to do here on White Sox Weekly. Also, always willing to take your calls to talk Sox with you. 312-332-3776. If you want to jump aboard, we'll take your calls up until our pregame coverage begins at 5:30. Hey, Sox fans. Bring your pup out to the ballpark on Tuesday, September 8th for Dog Day, sponsored by Tito's Handmade Vodka. Grab a seat in the outfield and watch the Sox take on the Pirates at 6:40. Limited availability to purchase tickets and prepaid parking. Visit whitesox.com/promos. I'm Jeff Meller. This is White Sox Weekly here on the ESPN Chicago Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Jeff Meller takes your calls after the game, ESPN Chicago.
Sox fans, join us at the ballpark for Family Sundays, presented by Coca-Cola, with tickets starting at just $12. There's fun for the whole family. To learn more and purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/Sunday. We do have a little bit of rotation news for the White Sox. Sean Burke, who was originally scheduled to start tomorrow, is going to be pushed back to Tuesday. Remember, the White Sox have that off day on Monday, so looks like they're going to get Sean Burke an extra day or two of rest, and he will go on Tuesday, and then he will be followed by Davis Martin on Wednesday. So right now, tomorrow is a TBA for the White Sox. Now, you know, a lot of this always depends on how tonight plays out. Will Venable frequently says, you know, they got to win today's game today and they'll worry about tomorrow. So they'll be pushing Sean Burke. Obviously, I suppose, you know, any of like someone like Urquidy could be in play as a bulk reliever. Noah Schultz is lined up to start in Charlotte tomorrow, which means they could always make a roster move if they wanted Noah Schultz to take the start. So there's a lot of choices for the White Sox. I mean, not that he would be an option tomorrow, but it's worth noting David Sandlin looked really good yesterday in his start for the Knights, 11 strikeouts, I believe. So wouldn't be surprised if we see David Sandlin make another appearance here at some point this year and even take a start for the White Sox. You know, it's something that actually I asked Chris Getz specifically about yesterday, about, you know, the starters not going deep into games and having to rely upon the bullpen. So we're going to let you hear from Chris Getz at the top of the hour at 5 o'clock. A lot of interesting things from the White Sox general manager. So you'll hear my question in there about that specifically, and plenty of other interesting thoughts from the White Sox GM as well. So I wanted to make sure I relayed that information to you about the White Sox rotation news. As we continue to take your calls, 312-332-3776. Speaking of thoughts on the rotation, let's start out with Ron, who's in Lowell, Indiana. Ronnie, what's going on, my friend?
Diehard White Sox fan for 50 years. Why can't they do something with Castillo and work with that guy? Man, they took a $25 million contract for next year, plus whatever if they have to pay him this year, and they gave up their top pitching catching prospect. I think Getz should have got one after Clay Holmes. That's what we were originally looking at. And look what he's doing with the Cubs.
And, Ron, they traded Boston Smith. And what I'll tell you about Boston Smith, and listen, he's had a great year, so I don't want to diminish Boston Smith in any way. He, as a hitter, he has been excellent this year. My conversations with some people who, you know a little bit more about the inner workings, I think the thought is that Boston Smith is honestly, he might be somebody who could catch in a pinch, but isn't necessarily defensively somebody who they think is a long-term solution defensively behind the plate in the majors. So that means that he's more likely, you know, probably a corner outfielder or, you know, maybe a first base type with, you know, the ability to maybe be, you know, an emergency catcher type. So I think that's why the White Sox were a little bit more open to, you know, moving him. You know, what he's capable of offensively, you know, that is still obviously yet to be determined. But I just think, you know, that's whenever you're trading for someone, you are going to have to give up something. And Boston Smith wasn't a top 10 prospect in the White Sox organization. So I think, you know, that was the thought process. You're right. Luis Castillo has not lived up to what they were hoping they were getting. They thought they were getting a veteran arm who at the very least could most times out give them five solid innings, so they wouldn't be taxing their bullpen, you know, nearly as much as they have as of late. They got one phenomenal start, his second start, his first here at Wrigley Field against the Reds, his former club, when he was ridiculous. You know, double-digit strikeouts, seven shutout innings that day. Or was it seven shutout? Might have given up one in a run. But nevertheless, he was outstanding that one start. Aside from that, everything else has been less than stellar. And the one thing I'll tell you is, in the postgame after Luis Castillo's latest start on Thursday against the Astros, Will Venable did not definitively back him as somebody who is going to continue to get starts over and over again. I think if Luis Castillo doesn't start to turn things around a little bit, give them some more quality outings, openers might be on the table for Luis Castillo. You know, we might be in a situation where the White Sox are looking at a piggyback reliever, somebody like a Urquidy, so that they could, or a Sandlin or a Schultz, who I just mentioned, you know, as somebody who they might look to, hey, if you can't get, you know, one time through the order, and after that, it's going to be we'll wait and see every day, every start, how it's going. And if you're rolling through three, you know, nine up, nine down, maybe we'll let you get a second time through the order. But I do think the White Sox at this point in time are in a spot where it doesn't matter what a guy's salary is. If they're not going to get better from Luis Castillo, I think Will Venable is going to be open to every possibility, because he understands that you can't go out there and not be competitive in games. They're going to need every win down the stretch here if they want to win the American League Central. And I promise you that Will Venable and Chris Getz understand that. And they're not going to let a salary be the reason why a guy continues to trot out there if he's not up to the task of doing the job. So it's been disappointing. I get it, Ron. I'm right there with you. I was hoping for better. That has not been the case, unfortunately, for the White Sox. But at the same time, you know, they acquired Luis Castillo without giving, I don't know what Boston Smith ends up being, but I just think they didn't want to give up a top 10 prospect in the organization, and Boston Smith was not in their top 10, and they didn't, you know, I think the problem is too, when you start, if you look at what the Cubs gave up for Clay Holmes, they gave up a top 100 prospect in baseball. So, you know, when I say that, like, obviously the White Sox could not trade Brock Chalowski, they had just drafted him, nor would they want to, right? So now the hard part is, like, if they wanted somebody like Clay Holmes, you're talking about probably Caleb Bonimer or Billy Carlson, who had to be in the deal if the White Sox were going to, you know, trump the Cubs offer. And honestly, I like Clay Holmes. I don't think he's the type of guy who you give up one of your top two hitting shortstop prospects for, at least. You know, Clay Holmes is somebody who, he's a ground ball pitcher. He is very reliant on a really good defense behind him. Now, you know, Sox fans might not want to hear this, but the Cubs have one of the best defenses in all of baseball this season. So part of the reason I think Clay Holmes has had a lot of success is because up the middle, the Cubs with Pete Crow Armstrong, Nico Horner, Dansby Swanson, when he's healthy, have one of the most elite, you know, up the middle defenses in all of baseball. And so I do think Clay Holmes in some ways is benefiting from that. I don't know if it would have been necessarily the exact same situation had the White Sox acquired him, nor would I wanted them to have traded away Caleb Bonimer or Billy Carlson to make that happen. So, you know, I get it. I will tell you this. The one name I kept bringing up, the guy I was hoping the White Sox might trade for, Reed Detmers, did not get moved at the deadline. And I think part of the reason is because nobody in baseball probably wanted to give up like a top 10, top 20 prospect. And I'll go back to it. That would have cost the White Sox probably Caleb Bonimer if they really wanted to do that. I don't think they really wanted to trade him away at this point. And, you know, and the other thing I'll say before we take a quick time out here is that the hard part is when you're trying to make a deal for a top end starter at the trade deadline, sometimes, even if you have a good farm system, sometimes the other team that is in possession of the starter that you're trying to acquire, sometimes they get hung up on one or two prospects in your system. And if you're not willing to part with them, sometimes they don't want to make a deal, period, end of story. And there's not much you can do to work around that. Sometimes they're just like, we want your top one or top two prospects in your farm system. And sometimes you just can't make a deal. So, the one thing I'll say is the White Sox have been extremely creative about covering innings this year. They figured out ways to do it. It was, again, one of my questions to Chris Getz yesterday, which you'll hear from at the top of the hour at 5 o'clock. 312-332-3776. When we come back, interesting Ask DJ question we had the other day. I loved DJ's answer, and then wouldn't you know it, less than 48 hours later, there was a major league player, a prominent major league player, who was immediately in violation of the one thing that Darren Jackson asked professional baseball players to do more of. I'll share that with you when we come back. This is the ESPN Chicago Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Hear Lennon DJ and High Def on 100.3 HD2.
Welcome back to White Sox Weekly. I'm Jeff Meller, ahead of Game 2 of 3 between the White Sox and Twins this evening. 6:10 first pitch, our pregame coverage on the ESPN Chicago Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network officially begins at 5:30. We're in the middle of White Sox Weekly, though, 2 hours prior to our pregame show every Saturday. And we also, I'm sure you probably know if you're a White Sox listener, but if you are unaware, we always do our Ask Len and Ask DJ features during our game broadcasts. Sixth inning, we ask whoever's day it is, hey, this is the question that was submitted by one of our listeners on social media. And so then we relay it to Len, Casper, or Darren Jackson each day. And then they obviously weigh in on what their thoughts are about the question. And We had a very interesting one on Thursday afternoon. I loved DJ's answer. And then wouldn't you know it, within 48 hours, we had a very prominent baseball player do exactly what DJ asked a player not to do. So I'll let you hear the question, and then I will give you what happened last night.
DJ, you've been around baseball your entire life. What's one piece of old school baseball wisdom that you still swear by, even if modern analytics departments might roll their eyes at it?
Well, let me wrap my head around that one, because we all had, believe it or not, we had analytics when I played, and it was just that we shared it, and it was vision. That was our analytic. But if anything, when you just mentioned the word old school, for me, there's one thing that you can control as a player all the time that you don't see enough of, but you're seeing some teams get back to it. Run hard everywhere. You know, it used to be you'd say to college kids, you'll never see a college kid not sprint on and off the field. We need to get back to feeling that way in pro ball.
Pena takes high.
Because you can control that. You know, beating a pitcher when you're swinging the bat's not easy, and there are things defensively, bad hops that you can't control, but you can always control your hustle effort.
Fouled on the screen behind the plate.
And I, for one, am kind of tired of hearing people make the excuse that, well, he's just taking a blow on his legs, not running this hard on the ground ball to short, because 99.9% of the time, no, I don't want to hear it. Run hard. It's 4.5 seconds at the longest of sprinting. 4.5 seconds or four times in a game. That's it. 20 seconds worth of sprinting a day in a game, I think, should be mandatory.
I could not agree more. I thought that was... You're not asking professional players to do much. Just run hard, right? Especially when you make contact with the ball, just run hard. And maybe even if you don't make contact with the ball, maybe if it's just, hey, you struck out swinging, and you know what? The ball got away from the catcher. So what? What's the worst case scenario? You run hard and you're thrown out at first base on a drop third strike, and so what? No big deal. You're still out, but at least you gave the bare minimum. I guess it's not the bare minimum, right? It's just run hard, play the sport that you grew up loving, and just show that you're trying to give your best effort. Well, sure enough, last night, that was not the case in Los Angeles, the Dodgers taking on the Nationals. And Kyle Tucker, the man who currently has the highest AAV in the entire sport. Now, he didn't sign the largest contract because, of course, that belongs to Shohei Ohtani, Juan Soto. But Kyle Tucker did sign a deal this offseason with the Dodgers to make him the highest average annually paid player, as he's making more than $60 million per season with the Dodgers. And if you haven't noticed, if you haven't been locked in a National League West baseball, I understand. But Kyle Tucker has been sorely disappointing for the Dodgers and what they thought they were acquiring when they signed the 29-year-old right fielder. He has struggled mightily. He is hitting .226 on the season. He has 12 home runs. I guess I should mention he did homer last night in the Dodgers victory. And he has an OPS of .686. That, folks, is not good. You know, you want to be at bare minimum in this. You want an OPS over 700. At the bare minimum, and if you're somebody making $60 million per year, usually they're hoping for an OPS that starts with an 8. And that has been something that Kyle Tucker generally has done throughout his career. In fact, every major league season in his career, he has an OPS that has started with 8, except for his rookie year when he played all of 28 games. So that's been the type of player that Kyle Tucker has been. This year, again, .686 OPS. He has not delivered on the big money deal that the Dodgers paid for. And so you would think, I would think, that when I'm having a disappointing season, as DJ just noted, the one thing I can control, no matter what, is my effort. Well, last night, when Kyle Tucker struck out, this occurred.
2-2 to Kyle Tucker. Taken for strike three. And sort of runs down to first. One gone in the fourth. Ooh, boy, Bernal juggled that for a moment, but they do get the out.
So you heard Joe Davis there on the Dodgers broadcast say about as judiciously, I think, as he could, Kyle Tucker takes strike three, and the ball was dropped by the catcher. And you heard Joe Davis say, and he sort of jogs down to first, and the ball was bobbled. Had Kyle Tucker been running hard, probably would have been safe at first base. At the very least, it would have been a play. But Kyle Tucker barely moved towards first base. It was the bare minimum that a player could do, this short of not running. And again, you love this is part of the reason why I think White Sox fans have really globbed onto this team and had so much fun with them is because you see Sam Antonacci start the game off and hustle for doubles whenever the opportunity arises. You see Miguel Vargas bust it down the line on every single infield ground ball that he hits, trying to make it close at the very least. You know, you see Chase Meidroth always, you know, diving for balls into defensively whenever the chance arises. You know, you see Tristan Peters hustling, and so you know, it's again, it's it's the bare minimum. Just run hard, and I think nobody will. You know, it's again, it's hard to live up to big money deals, but when you're struggling, you would think at the very least you would run hard, and it was just a picturesque example of exactly what Darren Jackson was talking about when he answered the question on Ask DJ on Thursday. Hey, as a big leaguer, 3-4 times a game, you run hard for 4 seconds. I don't think that's asking too much. You're getting paid to play a game, a child's game. You might as well just give your best effort, and the fan base will generally then give you a lot more leeway when you're struggling the way that Kyle Tucker is this year. I do want to note, too, you know, even though they're probably going to win the National League West, I'm not so sure that the Dodgers are going to be a team that makes as deep a run into the playoffs as they have the last couple of seasons when they've won the World Series. Shohei Ohtani is dealing with a couple of different injuries, a bicep, a knee injury. He hasn't gotten back on the mound. He was originally slated to return to the mound this previous Sunday. He did not. That was pushed back, and they're not quite sure when he's actually going to return to the mound for the Dodgers. If you look at a lot of their players, a lot of their big money signings are now at that stage of the career where they're in their early to mid 30s. And, you know, obviously Kyle Tucker at 29 was supposed to be that one bat that they brought in that could kind of add a little bit of oomph, you know, and that obviously has gone poorly for them. Will Smith, their catcher, who's a perennial all-star, he's been dealing with injuries all season. He finally just returned to their lineup, but he has not been the productive player that they normally are relying upon. You know, Mookie Betts, it looks like he's entered a different stage of his career. His OPS is barely above 700. He's at 724. So all of a sudden, you know, and Freddie Freeman, even though the OPS is good at 844, it seems like his power is not at the same rates that it once was. So, look, the Dodgers are loaded. I get it. But I'm just saying they're showing some cracks in the armor, and it could be that I think I wouldn't be stunned if another team makes it through the National League this year. Hey, Sox fans, join us at the ballpark for Family Sundays presented by Coca-Cola. With tickets starting at just $12, there's fun for the whole family. To learn more and purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/Sunday. When we come back, oh man, we had quite the ump show in Colorado last night. I'll share that with you if you missed it. What's going on, man? We'll talk about it. This is the ESPN Chicago Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Stream the games live on the ESPN Chicago app.
Well, you see him tilt towards his hat. He is telling Rincon to put his hat on straight, is what he is telling him to do. And that's why Leo was laughing behind the plate. Like, are you serious, dude? If that's in fact what happened, if Doug Eddings behind the plate was telling Rincon to fix his hat, that is a flat-out embarrassment. That is not his job to do. He's not wearing his hat backwards. This wasn't a uniform violation. This was a guy just wearing his hat the way that he wears his hat, if in fact that's what happened.
And if that's what happened, how come nobody says anything to Jazz Chisholm?
Well, maybe he hasn't had Doug innings, which is impossible.
One ball, two strikes. If that's the case, that's a joke. Straight away center. And Goodman's going to be retired. Well, sometimes umpires think it's their game, their field. It's not. They are the officials. They're in charge. But it's the player's game, I thought.
Well said there by Chip Carey and Brad Thompson on the Cardinals broadcast yesterday. Doug Eddings, the home plate umpire in last night's Cardinals-Rockies game, with a Cardinals pitcher making his big league debut. And listen, I don't care if you don't like the way someone wears their hat. As they noted, short of it being backwards, we've seen at this point damn near 20 years of players wearing their hats slightly off center. So I think we need to get past that. And the fact that Doug Eddings, when a kid was making his big league debut, chose to make it an ump show. And by the way, when Ali Marmol went out there to argue with Doug Eddings, he was ejected. And that's the Cardinals manager. They also gave Rincon, the Cardinals pitcher making his debut, a pitch clock violation. And then shortly thereafter, Doug Eddings then blew an obvious call at home plate when a Rockies runner was clearly tagged out. And the Doug Eddings decided not to call him out. And because the Cardinals no longer had a challenge, then they were unable to do anything about it. And it looked like, I don't know for a fact, but it certainly could have been considered vindictive by Doug Eddings for his choice to enforce some imaginary uniform code on a Cardinals rookie pitcher who was making his big league debut. Just terrible. Ali Marmol, after the game, explained what had been told to him by Doug Eddings.
Some words exchanged there. Quite honestly, I thought it was pretty embarrassing on his end. We have a kid making his debut, and in between an at-bat, he tells him that he needs to fix his hat, and the kid's not going to wear his hat like that on my field. So last I checked, this was Coors Field. So I took issues with it. And then the pitch violation while I'm out there having a discussion, that's also stupid in my opinion. So there's a lot of moving parts to that one. At the end of the day, I thought they handled it poorly, and I'd like an explanation at some point.
Yeah, I will see how Major League Baseball chooses to follow up with an explanation to Oliver Marmol, the Cardinals manager, and we'll see what they do in regards to Doug Eddings and his choices in last night's game. Again, as Ansel Rincon was making his major league debut for the Cardinals, quite the introduction to the big leagues. I'll give Chip Carey a little bit of credit here, too. I enjoyed his final call when the Cardinals actually came back to beat the Rockies. Ivan Herrera hit a big home run in the ninth, and the Cardinals held on for the win. And Chip Carey with the exclamation point.
The pitch. He got him. The Cardinals win it. They were dug a hole, but it's a happy Eddings in Colorado. The Cardinals take game one here at Coors Field.
This was awesome.
I enjoyed it. Listen, if you can't enjoy that moment, I don't know. I can't help you. I was happy to see Chip Carey go ahead and put his stamp on a nice win for the Cardinals last night. 312-332-3776. Again, that's the number if you want to jump aboard and talk some White Sox. We can take your calls up until 5:30, but after that, we will be in our official network pregame show with the White Sox and Twins first pitch coming your way at 6:10 this evening here at Wright Field. Hey, White Sox fans, join us at the ballpark September 17th as the Sox take on the Detroit Tigers at 6:40. One of the most iconic looks in White Sox history returns to honor Tim Anderson's retirement from Major League Baseball. That's right. Don't miss the return of the South Side, presented by United. To purchase tickets and prepaid parking, visit whitesox.com/promos. When we come back, we will let you hear from White Sox general manager Chris Getz. He met with us, the media, yesterday, touched on a wide variety of topics, which we will share with you. This is the ESPN Chicago Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Sox games on the go, the ESPN Chicago app.
Sox fans, join us for $5 Tuesdays. All fans enjoy a specially priced $5 concessions menu, including draft beers from Miller Lite or Modelo, Garrett popcorn, stadium buttery, Vienna beef hot dogs or Polish sausages, Beggar's pizza slices, nachos, and select Coca-Cola products. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/Tuesdays. Jeff Meller back here at Right Field. We're going to let you hear from White Sox general manager Chris Getz here in a moment. Let's pause 10 seconds for stations to identify themselves first.
This is ESPN Chicago, home of the White Sox. WMVP WTBC HD2 Chicago, a Good Karma Sports radio station.
We are getting set for game number 2 of 3 between the White Sox and Twins this evening. 6:10 first pitch. White Sox GM Chris Getz met with the media prior to yesterday's game and covered a wide variety of topics.
All right, well, it's good to be back at home. You know, Kyle Teal joining the club tonight, which we're excited about. You know, just inject what he brings to a club, into our lineup, in team, is a big deal to us, and excited to see how it plays out. You know, the current or the most recent road trip, obviously played really well in Minnesota, won that series, and had some opportunities in Houston to capture perhaps some more wins there, but we came out with one, and you know, on we go back here against Minnesota again, and look forward to, you know, seeing how the month plays out. But it, you know, it starts with tonight and certainly this series. To be in first place, you know, on this date, is pretty remarkable, and we're excited to get this opportunity to play some really meaningful, exciting baseball games. And I know Will and the staff and the players they're ready to go because they've done it all year. You look at, you know, every month being 500 or better. So you know, with the attitude and what they bring on a daily basis, you know, based on historical, because of the success we've had in the past months, every month that we've played, you know, I'm very optimistic we'll be able to do the same thing this month.
What we know how much you guys value Romo and what he, the intangibles he brings, and then you obviously like Jake Rogers too. You went out and got him. How did that decision come down? Where you made the decision?
Yeah, not easy. Drew's done a really nice job. He has, and you know what he does with the pitching staff, and you know, just the overall value it brings to the club is something that has helped us and has gotten us to where we are today. You know, and now you got to make these decisions. Kyle, you know, is someone that yeah, obviously we believe in as well, and we know what he's capable of doing because he's done it. And so, yeah, I mean, Drew's gonna stay ready. He's actually gonna stay with our club, you know, help the group continue to go. And if another opportunity arises, he'll be ready for it.
How confident are you in Kyle's health right now? I mean, obviously he's dealt with some weird things this year, but do you feel like he had the work built up to, you know, go down the stretch for you guys?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the feedback from both Kyle and the medical staff, everyone seems to be really confident that, you know, his lower half is in a really good spot. Yeah, he's been hit with a couple, you know, lower half injuries, and but it seems to be behind him. We hope that it is because we need him. We do, and he's a big part of this, and I think he's going to be, you know, an added boost to this club. So, yeah, we're still going to be mindful of making sure that, you know, he feels strong and can be productive throughout this final month. But, yeah, goes without saying, we're very excited to have him here.
After everything that he's had this year, how do you get him to trust his body after 3 injuries?
You know, I think, you know, every player that, you know, plays this game, you learn more about yourself, you know, every game and every season, quite honestly. And I think he's, you know, he's such a young player, and he's just getting his major league career going. And, you know, he's only gone through a couple off seasons, and, you know, you eventually adapt, you adjust to what it takes to stay healthy and be productive. That's just part of the evolution and the development of players. And we try to educate these guys and guide them and support them with, you know, what they need, and
You know, so it's been a learning curve, but sometimes there's just freak injuries that are going to happen too. So you try to learn from it and you know, set these players up for future success. But you know, he feels good right now, and we'll just take it from there.
Chris, well, what he said after the game last night, he has to remind himself to stay positive with what he's been going through the last month. Is that something you guys have to keep an eye on? And how confident are you that, you know, he's going to keep that frame of mind?
Yeah, well, you know, it's you know, you've got a support staff, you've got hitting coaches, you know, whomever that's interacting with them, you know, if players go through, you know, different experiences throughout their season, they're riding the highs and at times riding the lows a little bit, and that's why, you know, this clubhouse has been so successful, because they've supported one another. And, you know, it's not just one player. I know Mune wants to be productive on a regular basis, but there are other players that have stepped up along the way. Let's just go out there and compete. He's still a threat at the plate, even though he doesn't feel like he's perhaps optimal on a at-bat-to-at-bat basis, but that doesn't mean he's not taking his walks, or and just the threat that he brings to the table is impactful to the entirety of the lineup.
How can you analyze your starting rotation right now, and do you want some adjustments to be used at that point?
Well, it you know, for one, Sean Burke and Davis Martin, you know, starting with Davis, you know, being able to get him a breather going on the IL with the blister, building him back up and have the performance he did in Houston, you know, was tremendous. So to have that, you know, back into the rotation is going to be a big boost. And, you know, to mix in quality starts is, you know, is significant, because it balances out our bullpen. Our bullpen has been, you know, one of our strengths this year. But we all know that if we're asking too much of the bullpen, that it comes at a cost later. So to be able to have Sean seemingly back on track, and Davis and Anthony Kay doing what he's doing, we know that it's going to take a depth of guys. We've got guys that are throwing really well in AAA, whether it be Thorpe, Sandlin, and Noah Schultz. And so we've got options, we've got depth, and it's really about keeping our bullpen strong and scoring enough offensively and playing good defense that should keep us afloat, because that's what we've done all year.
How do you look at Luis Castillo, what he's been doing and some of the issues he's had?
Yeah, and there's some mechanical stuff that we've been working on. Obviously, you know, he had that start against Cincinnati, and he showed everyone what he's capable of doing. I do think that when players come over in trades, you know, it's a transition. It can be. And, you know, sometimes players put on or carry a little bit too much and carry the burden of trying to justify a trade and winning teammates over and a manager over and coaches over and fans and media. And that's just part of the transition. And so there's probably a little bit of that. Now, just mechanically, I know he did make some strides yesterday. He did. I mean, you know, there were some lower half mechanics that they were working on, and that seemed to be in a much better place now. You know, the upper half, the shoulders seem to be flying open a little bit more than it had in the past. I think the pitch shapes were trending in the right direction. The velocity was affected a little bit, so not quite to, he's not exactly where we want him to be, or what he's showing what he's capable of doing, but that doesn't mean we don't continue to work. And that's kind of the beauty of what we do and what we've done. We'll continue to do so, find ways to solve for problems and issues and make adjustments. And, you know, Davis Martin and Sean Burke are great examples of that. And you know, we hope to be able to apply that for Castillo and get him back on track.
How intriguing was it to go after someone like Tommy Pham, who the organization knows well, but also somebody who Will Venable has some experience with? How much did Will's input matter in that?
Yeah, I mean, he definitely was part of that, or Will was part of that conversation. You know, they have a really good relationship. We have, you know, some players in there, and certainly others throughout the organization are familiar because of the 2024 season. And, you know, he was a productive player for us. And anyone that's been around Tommy and how he approaches the game, you know, I, you know, we just felt like it was a nice add. It provided depth, outfield depth. You know, we're looking at what we were had in Charlotte. And obviously with rosters expanding, there's different ways to go about it. But we felt like, you know, the best plan of attack to really filling out the roster was to grab another outfielder, right-handed bat. You know, our lineup's been really strong against right-handed pitching, and we've been exposed a little bit at times against left-handed pitching. So to have another weapon, you know, in the lineup on occasion, and then of course off the bench, we felt like it was the right move for us.
Monet has been a game changer for the organization in so many different ways. Going to even you guys just having, you know, 10-day trip out there scouting Japan and the interest out there. You spoke a little bit on a podcast about interest on both sides and extending them out. How would you, if you could, characterize those conversations or just the interest in keeping him beyond what you have him for?
Yeah, I mean, Mune's meant a lot to this organization. He has. He's been part of the success that we've had this year. It's helped us win games. It's helped others gain confidence up here and belief that you can win games. So that's certainly something that, you know, we're grateful for and, you know, thankful that we've gotten the opportunity to get to know him further. He's you know, a tremendous teammate, hard worker, and he's been productive. I know right now, you know, he hasn't been as productive as he had been earlier in the year, but, you know, he's still a threat at the plate, taking his walks, and we know that he's a power threat. So, yeah, we're going to continue to have those conversations and see where it takes us.
So there you go. Chris Getz addressing the idea that the White Sox are open to signing Munetaka Murakami to an extension if it serves his side as well. Sox fans, be here on Friday, September 18th, as the White Sox take on the Tigers at 6:40. And then stick around after the game for a post-game concert featuring Cole Swindell, presented by Xfinity. Exclusive on-field passes are on sale now with limited availability. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/concert. Jeff Meller here on White Sox Weekly at Rate Field as we're getting set for game number 2 of 3 between the Sox and Twins. Anthony Kay on the mound for the White Sox. Taj Bradley will toe the rubber for Minnesota. When we come back, a little bit more from the White Sox GM. This is the ESPN Chicago Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
The Rich Eisen Show, weekdays, noon to 2, ESPN Chicago.
Welcome back to White Sox Weekly. I'm Jeff Meller, White Sox and Twins. Game number 2 of 3 coming your way this evening at 6:10. Pre-game coverage will officially begin for our network at 5:30. But as always, thanks for joining us. 2 hours prior to every pregame show on Saturdays, we talk White Sox with you. Had a fun conversation with John Greenberg of The Athletic earlier today, talking about the new renderings for the ballpark near the 78, actually across the river, for what the Ishbia and his development team are calling the rail yards. So we had talked to John Greenberg about that earlier today. If you missed it, check it out on the podcast, available for you on the ESPN Chicago app. Hey, Sox fans, upgrade your game day with a private suite, the perfect space to host your closest friends and family with customizable food and beverage options. For more information, visit whitesox.com/suites or call 312-674-1000. All right, so here's a little more from White Sox general manager Chris Getz, who met with the media prior to yesterday's game.
And then, I guess, similar question with Will Venable. I guess, how would you evaluate him, and have there been conversations about extending him past next year?
Yeah, Will's been fantastic. He's done, you know, what we wanted and beyond. He really has. He's been a great partner to me. He's been a great teammate to the coaching staff and the players. So, you know, he's definitely a guy that is of high value to us, and want to continue to find ways to nurture that relationship, and you know, definitely want him to be part of what we continue to build right now.
Have there been talks or anything about extending him right now?
We're focused on winning games right now, and that's just not a concern, just because of the relationship Will and I have.
Chris, the numbers guys said that you guys had like a 2% chance to win the division. Obviously off numbers wise, but how did they get it so wrong?
Gosh, you know, I think, you know, not to go deep dive into projection system, it's a young team. There's unpredictability. There's variance in a Murakami. There's variance in a lot of different players. You know, Vargas taking a huge step forward, Tristan Peters, and not knowing exactly how we're going to, you know, put together a strategy with how we use our bullpen and our pitching staff and our style of play. you know, I think it's the beauty of sports. It's you got to play the games, and we've got a group that really likes playing together, and certainly go out every night, and they're not scared of anyone. And I, it obviously wasn't fully captured before the season started, but it seemingly is captured now. And you know, that's why we believe in so many different processes that we have in place. I know many have said that we're ahead of schedule. Those types of comments have been made, but really it's validation for the work where we've been in. We feel like this, these results are just a byproduct of hard work for years and going about things, a certain way, and then, breathing confidence into that clubhouse and finding different ways to fuel the team. And so all of that is baked into the performance on the field. And we're just going to continue to stay at it, maneuver when we need to, keep this team hungry.
When you were breaking camp and going to Milwaukee to start the season, did it ever cross your mind that there'd be a Mike Vasil giveaway one night at Raid Field?
There are a lot of things that were not on the bingo card this year, and that's including that one. Obviously, he's meant a lot to.
Can you expound a little bit about? I mean, because obviously it's a fun thing, but just right. What he's meant to that clubhouse.
I've talked about it before. End of spring training, you're obviously putting together your active roster, and then there's. Different ways to go about rehabs, and he wasn't going to pitch this year, but Will pulled me aside and said, Vass means so much to this team. What he brings is supporting his teammates, the energy, he's hilarious, and let's inject that into this clubhouse. And I think Will deserves a lot of credit for doing that, because I think it certainly has given us, an edge. It has. And, did we anticipate it turning into, him dressing up as a wizard and having a wand giveaway? Of course not. But it's also it's been part of this 2026 right. season. And I think, when fans are looking to connect with the team that they have, and it's a very likable group, mainly because of how they play on the field and the energy and the comebacks. But I think a lot of people can just relate to this team and the fun that they have, because they just enjoy what they do, and Vass has been a part of that.
What's been the craziest thing that you've said? I can't believe this actually is a thing, but it really is this year, because you've had about 9 or 10 of them this year.
Well, I mean, what falls into what's crazy and not, but I don't have a good answer for that one either. But there has been a long list of us.
Mike, it's very unusual for a player that's injured, as long as that stays with the club. Usually, they go to Arizona for the rehab. Why did he think that was important to him, and it turned out to be important to the organization?
Will recognize that, and I think he's certainly the best one to answer that, and it speaks to Will's pulse that he has on the clubhouse and the guys, it's not something that specifically how Vassell is as a person. It's not something that in Will's career, I'm sure, both as a player, a coach and a bench coach, and now a manager, that he said, well, I remember this reminds me of a case that he had back then. That I assure you that's not it. It's more, there are times where there is a something unique about a club, and his willingness and confidence to let Vass be himself, and I think it's very much symbolic of, Will's belief that it's important for players to be who they are, and having Vassil around, I think, brings a level of comfort to a lot of people.
Speaking of Vassil, how about his roommate? Probably Chase gets tagged as like the third player in that deal, but now, right now, like in terms of war standings, is probably one of the more valuable second basemen in the league. Has your idea, or how has having him in the organization maybe expanded your idea of what his ceiling is?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's when you make any acquisition, okay, you look at what the skill set is, what are the, you know, objectively the makeup. You know, he was a guy that had always gotten on base in a high clip, contact ability, defensive versatility, being shortstop, second. We know that he could play third more if we asked him to do that. You know, that skill set in itself, I you know, has always played well at the major league level. Certainly right now, there's always a place for that skill set on a major league club. And now we're discovering that it can be part of a winning baseball club, a championship caliber club. And, you know, so, you know, this offseason, he attacked the bat speed program. He did. And you know, he's gotten into a little bit more power, and his slug has gone up. He's still evolving as a player. And you know, you look at the jump that a Miguel Vargas has made, or a Tristan Peters, or you know, there's plenty of examples of players. That's why you continue to find ways to improve. He's very self-driven, and we're here to guide him. And you know, you never want to cap anyone, and we're certainly, you know, not in the business of doing that for any of our players either. We just want to continue to find ways to get players better.
Chris, you've been able to stack wins in a rather unorthodox way, in that I think you have the second fewest innings from your starting pitching. Part of that's a product of the way the organization has embraced the opener, but also the way Will's willing to deploy the bullpen. Is there any concern down the stretch here that the bullpen has been overtaxed, or are you happy with where you're at?
You're always concerned about, you know, that type of taxing a bullpen. Now, I'll be honest with you, we've kind of continued down the trend of how we've been operating, and we've remained in first place, and we feel like, you know, it's got a chance to continue that way throughout the month. Now, you got to find ways to you know, cover those innings, starter innings, and, you know, that's why getting Sean Burke and Davis Martin back on track, that's why it's going to be important to get Castillo on track, that's why it's important to have an Urquidy that has that kind of versatility and swingman ability. And we've got a very, you know, we've got a kind of a group of guys that can do that. Sean Newcomb's done that all year. You know, it becomes less daunting if you start looking at the amount of arms that you have that can cover, you know, 12 outs. And certainly that comes with both, you know, just the capacity to do that, but also to get, you know, hitters out from both sides. And we've been able to develop guys that have been able to execute that, add guys, you know, throughout the year. And so we've got different ways of going about this. We're certainly, you know, welcoming of starters going out there, go deeper in games, because it does kind of reset the bullpen. But if that's not the case, then we'll continue to stay creative and find guys that can just cover innings and give us quality innings in the bullpen as well.
Coincidentally enough, the White Sox bullpen covered 12 outs yesterday in their win over the Twins. I found that kind of funny that was the number that Chris Getz threw out there in the pregame as he was addressing my question about the White Sox bullpen potentially being overtaxed here down the stretch. But as you heard from him, confident that the team can figure out ways, and happy to be in first place here on September 5th as we head into the Labor Day weekend. I'm Jeff Meller here on White Sox Weekly. If you missed it too, earlier this week, the White Sox center fielder rookie Tristan Peters was named the American League Rookie of the Month because in August he was awesome. Batted .320 with a .414 on base and a .640 slug, 6 home runs, 14 ribbies, 14 runs scored, 10 walks in 27 games in August. He led AL rookies in homers, slugging percentage, and OPS. And, of course, among his accomplishments, Tristan Peters homered in 5 straight games from August 22nd through the 26th, matching the franchise record, which he now shares with his teammate Munetaka Murakami, who did it earlier this year, A.J. Pierzynski, Paul Konerko, Carlos Lee, Frank Thomas, who did it twice in 1994, Ron Kittle, and Greg Lozinski. Peters became the 14th rookie in Major League history to homer in 5 straight games and the 3rd White Sox rookie to accomplish that feat, along with Murakami and the aforementioned Ron Kittle. Also, one more piece of White Sox news for you before we get out of here. The White Sox announced the 2027 spring training schedule. That's right, folks. In conjunction with Major League Baseball, the White Sox Cactus League opener takes place on Friday, February 19th at the LA Dodgers in Glendale, Arizona. Of course, the White Sox share their complex with the Dodgers. The Dodgers will be the home team for that game. The 2027 spring training schedule includes 15 home games at Camelback Ranch, including weekend games against the Padres on February 26th, Cleveland February 27th, Arizona February 28th, and the Cubs on March 12th, the Dodgers March 13th, and the Athletics on March 21st. So schedule is always subject to change, but if you want more information, check out whitesox.com/spring. That, folks, is going to wrap up this edition of White Sox Weekly. As always, I want to say thank you to our guest, John Greenberg of The Athletic, joined me earlier today. The executive producer of White Sox Baseball is Brendan Riley. Great work by Aiden O'Connor back at our ESPN Chicago Board of Trade studios. We're going to take a quick timeout, and when we come back, we'll start the pregame show here on the White Sox Radio Network as we get set for White Sox and Twins. Pregame starts at 5:30. First pitch coming your way at 6:10. This is the ESPN Chicago Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.